Call this meeting of Lincoln County Board of Commissioners to order. This is Wednesday, March 21st, and we are in the Board of Commissioners' room in the courthouse. First item is to establish a quorum. We have all three commissioners present. Next item on our agenda would be adoption of the consent calendar. These are items of a routine nature or items that have come before the commissioners before. Is there any item commissioner would wish to highlight?
Mr. Chair, I would move for approval of the consent calendar as presented.
Second.
Moved and seconded. All those in favor say aye.
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 That motion carries. Next item on our agenda is a public hearing. This is a continued hearing of the legalization of Ocean View Drive. I believe the first item is for me to open a public hearing. Public hearing is now open. We'll have a report.
I'll give the report.
Okay. Councilor Belmont.
This particular matter, as you recall, is the legalization of Ocean View Drive and Yahats that we've been discussing for some time. This is part of the process of setting this particular road up for transfer to the city of Yahats as part of, really, overall, something's been going on for years, and that's the 804 Trail and Ocean View Drive issues down there. We actually had a discussion with the city council and Yahats at our joint meeting recently, in which we talked about some alternatives to having to complete this legalization, including doing some easements, having the city work on a plan for traffic flow in there, with a one-way plan for a portion of that, and then the improvements that the county would be providing to the road prior to the time that we do the transfer. And those things are underway and working, and so it may be that we don't need, again, to do this legalization. So what we'd like to do is just get a motion from you to continue this while we continue our work. And so the motion would be to continue this to May 23rd at 9:30 a.m. in this room.
So moved.
Second. Moved and seconded. Any other discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 That motion carries. Council Belmont, do I just close the public hearing?
Yeah, close the hearing. We'll come back on the 23rd. No, you go ahead.
Okay. Close the public hearing. Thank you. Next item is a second public hearing on the LID, which is a local improvement district for Alder Springs. This will be presented by Roy Kenyon, and public hearing is now open.
Good morning, commissioners. We are at, I guess, the second to last
step. Would you identify yourself?
Oh, sorry about that. Roy Kenyon, Lincoln County Public Works Director. This has been a long ongoing project. It was a declared emergency fix for basically Alder Springs, which is off of Highway 34 on the south side of the LC. And as part of that, there was an agreement between the community and the county for the community to basically pay back the cost of the repair. And we are now to the point where the assessment notice has been sent out. This is the opportunity for any one of the 19 property owners to speak up regarding the assessment. And then at the end of that, we hope then to get an order to finalize and then to start collecting payments for the repair.
Okay.
Good morning, Commissioners. Kristen Ewell, Assistant County Attorney. Has the hearing already been opened and closed?
Yes. No, okay. Open. The hearing, public hearing is open.
Okay. Did you take input?
No.
I was waiting for staff report, and I will take public input.
Great.
Is there any more from the staff? Any questions from commissioners? Okay. This time, public has an opportunity to provide testimony. Is there anyone that wishes to address the board at this time? All right.
This is the Alder Springs matter.
On the Alder Springs matter. Thank you for clarifying that.
Yes.
Public hearing on the Alder Springs Local Improvement District. All right. Seeing no one come forward, close the public hearing. Public hearing is now closed. Additional comments, questions from the board.
What's our next step?
So the next step would be for staff to prepare an order certifying the amounts of assessment. And for the properties that are specially benefited. So Public Works would send out those assessments. It would be recorded with the clerk's office as a lien on the property. So if that's agreeable, next week an order can be prepared for your consideration.
And we also need the board to approve an interest rate for this. The last LID we did, which was 6-7 years ago, something like that, the interest rate was set at 3.25. I think that we've agreed that the county would be okay with continuing in that rate if the board so sees.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
Me too.
So we have concurrence on both the interest rate and the not assessments, but liens.
Yes.
Okay. We'll have an order come before us at the next meeting.
Yes.
Okay. And just for your information, we've actually already had one of the 19 property owners pay up in full. I don't believe that this is going to be a long drawn out thing. Everybody it's a low amount. I think everybody was glad to have it done. We had almost 100% approval when the ballot went out. So this is just basically dotting our I's and crossing our T's and finishing it up.
Well, I think, again, I'll emphasize that I think all of the parties are working cooperatively and that really this isn't being done under an adversarial environment. It's simply a matter of the legal process, and we're certainly, again, all working together.
That is true.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, we'll move on to our next item, which is a decision item on the agreement between Lincoln County and Arduous Group for recruitment of the director position with Health and Human Services. I believe we have a couple of individuals to share some comments.
Good morning, Commissioners. Michael Herford, Director of Personnel. We have, just quickly to go through this, it was a group of us that consisted of myself and counsel Kristen Yule and Jerry Herbage. We reviewed a number of firms, selected out of the firms, I think, four that we took very close look at. And then from that, we did actual interviews with two. One was HRIC and the other one was Arias. And determined that both were probably qualified with different distinctions in terms of strengths and weaknesses. Finally, contemplated over the weekend, and then I had a follow-up conversation with Arias and feel that this firm is in excellent position to give us good service. I checked their references out. References were impeccable in terms of the work that they've done, very satisfied clients. And I'm very confident in recommending to you all that we enter into an agreement with RIS to find us an executive director for HHS.
Mr. Herbage?
Yes, for the record, I'm Jerry Herbage, Assistant County Counsel. And I basically agree with the statements made by Mike Herford here. What I would like to emphasize to the board is that this was that a lot of due diligence was involved in this process, that all of the firms that were contacted provided materials for our review, that our interview of the top two candidates was between half an hour and 45 minutes each. We took this very seriously, and we're happy with the selection, at least the recommendation of Arias to provide the services for the executive search for a director for Health and Human Services. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. If any questions about the fee or anything of the process.
Commissioner? Yeah, I do have some questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Their proposal calls for, rather than a fixed fee, 30% of the selected candidate's first-year compensation. Is this a typical way now in search firms to set their fees?
It's a good question, and of the four firms that submitted materials, three of them were based on that. One was fixed.
And so it seems like it's common in the industry to do that.
Okay. Let's see, it's been now, I believe, about 2 months since the leadership change at HHS and when Rebecca Austin accepted appointment as the interim director. She indicated she was hoping for no more than 6 months in that position. So as there was part of the discussion with Arias, you know, do they think that they can conduct a national search and get a candidate placed within 4 months? Is that realistic, or is that, given, you know, the type of position we're trying to fill here, can that be accomplished? And if not, can we talk with Ms. Austin about potentially extending her interim status?
I think that we can do that. Mike has...
If I may, Commissioner, yeah. I have spoken to the chief person who would be our liaison with the firm, and they have informed me that they have what I would kind of term two or three in the oven, so to speak. They're doing simultaneous searches. They do with a lot of rural health care settings, and so they've done kind of preliminary review of candidates that they think would be a good fit for us, and they've informed me that we could have resumes that we would be looking at by the end of this week.
That's encouraging. Another question I have is, are they going to help us? Are we going to have some interaction on whether our compensation package is competitive? The reason I say that, I know it's not simply a case of throwing money at a person. You have to find somebody who truly wants to be here and is a good fit. But this is the largest department in this county. It's... You know, just the duties that go with this are so significant. I don't want to be out of the market competitively before we even start, if we're not at least in a ballpark to negotiate with the caliber of candidate we need.
I suspect that we're going to have to make a adjustment to our salary that we were previously paying. How much, I don't know. I think it depends on the candidate, the breadth of experience that they've had. But I think it's safe to say that we will have to do more than what we were previously doing. It's a very competitive market. We're in competition with the private sector, the nonprofit sector, and they themselves are into you're seeing the result of that through bonus, sign-on bonuses and lucrative incentives for people. We're obviously, you know, a governmental agency, and we've got constraints, and our intent is to pay what we have to pay in order to get somebody who's got the prerequisite skills that we're looking for. But we'll, you know, we'll negotiate tough on that.
Okay. Another question I've got is regarding the back and forth between us and them on shaping the job description, because I think the changeover, well, this has helped bring to light that we need some fundamental cultural change within the HHS organization. I mean, the Soiring report underlined what we already know, that the boots on the ground service delivery is really, for the most part, excellent to outstanding, but organizational culture needs a significant overhaul. Stakeholder community relations need to be prioritized in a way they haven't. And instituting, you know, modern progressive fiscal management measures is going to be another priority, I think. And that's going to take a different skill set probably than we have had in this position for decades. So I just really want to make sure that as we attract candidates that they know what we're looking for.
I've had extensive conversations with a number of the recruiting firms just to get their interest and explained much of that dynamic that we have both internal and external stakeholders. It's a complicated operation to run. It's going to require a high level of administrative skill and concurrently a understanding of the healthcare industry. And within that, that takes into account you've got behavioral health, primary care, and public health, that you're going to have to feel comfortable navigating your way through that and providing leadership. They think that the people are out there. They're you know, they're not going to kid us and say that we're going to get somebody for a blue light special, but I think that they know that those skill sets are available and that they're confident that after I went through and described to them, and we did it in our interview process, we talked at some length about culture, they have a high level of confidence that they'll be able to fill our position. And I might add that when I checked the references, I basically went over that a little bit with the people that were given to me as references, and they all expressed that they had a high level of confidence in what they had done for them, and that they would go back again and use them again if the need was necessitated. So, I think that they've got a good understanding. They understand rural health care in particular. They do a lot of placements. And so I think they're about as well positioned as I've ever found a recruiter to be in terms of trying to fill this position. It is complicated. I think we were wise. You all were wise to appoint Rebecca Austin for a six-month period. We don't want to be rushed on the decision. We want to make a good decision and make sure that all the stakeholders have crossed off and that they feel confident, a high level of confidence with the individual that we eventually pick.
No, that's all I had right now, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
I have a couple of thoughts. Number one, you shared with me one of the reasons that company was selected over others, and it had to do with their expertise in this area. Could you just highlight that provide some details?
Yes. Commissioner, when we interviewed them, they presented a team approach in terms of discussing what the various aspects of this job were. They had somebody that had worked in human resources for quite some time. They had somebody that had done a lot of placements in rural settings. And so they understood, I think, the complexities of what we're looking for better than, the other people I'd talked to. And it was that team approach that I thought was important for us, so that they understood that it was just wasn't one person's impression. I had made a comment about a couple of issues that we faced, and the person who had come from HR picked up on it just immediately and said, "Well, this is what these are the kinds of problems you're facing, correct?" And so they were tuned right in. And so it was those aspects that I saw that I thought were genuinely impressive in terms of their ability to understand the complexity of this position.
I guess the last thing is I'd like to clarify the aspects of the Sorghum Report. Commissioner Hall mentioned it, and I think there are some that feel the Sorghum Report is now the guideline, the playbook for Health and Human Services. And certainly from my standpoint, that's absolutely not the case. The Sorghum Report provided some information, but I'm looking for a Health and Human Services director that, as you indicated, understands the complexities of delivering these services, can look at the organization, can look at how the services are delivered, what services are needed in the future, and direct the department in that direction. So, again, from my standpoint, the Sorghum Report is simply a report that provides some information.
I had a Sorghum representative in my office this morning that we talked. He's doing a project for Samaritan Health, and he wanted to stop by and just say hello and check in. And I commented to him, no report that you get is ever going to cover everything and capture the essence of what all of the issues are and what the culture's like 100%. It's just not possible to come in and do that kind of report. What they did capture, I think, were some important key issues, fundamental issues that needed attention. And in that respect, I wouldn't say that they hit the ball out of the park, but they hit a lot of issues that we kind of had questions about on our mind, whether or not there was some accuracy and whether or not their acumen or understanding the operation was as it should be. I can tell you that I have subsequently done further research into some items, and I think that their recommendations that they made, while not 100% spot on, basically were pretty close to what we needed for somebody to come in and capture the high points in terms of issues that need immediate action.
Again, there's certainly areas that they highlighted. They've made recommendations, but it's not the game plan, the game book going forward.
Right.
All right. Any other comments or questions? I believe we need a motion to approve the order.
It's pronounced Arias. Is that correct?
That is correct. They're out of Nebraska, Omaha.
Uh-huh. Mr. Chair, I would move we approve the proposed agreement between Lincoln County and Arias Group for recruitment for the director position of Lincoln County Health and Human Services.
Second.
Moved and seconded. Any other discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right, next items. We have a couple of discussion information items. The first one is an opportunity grant for Brown Park. And I believe Keith Andreessen will be addressing the board. Come forward. And again, for the record, please introduce yourself.
Good morning, Commissioners. I'm Keith Andreessen. I'm the Parks Operations Supervisor for Lincoln County Parks Department. What we have before you today is the grant from the County Opportunity Grant. It is monitored and administered by the Oregon State Parks. It is funded through Oregon RV registration dollars. So for every RV that is registered in Oregon or through gas taxes paid through the RVs, then that fund is split up into construction projects, which is the County Opportunity Grants. Then we also receive a little bit in maintenance fees every year to help care and upkeep our parks. So about a year ago, you approved me to apply for a grant through the local government grant. That grant was denied. I took the funds that were pre-approved at that time with the approval of the Public Works Director and applied for the County Opportunity Grant. And we had to scale down the size of the project because we weren't able to use matching property values on this one. So on this grant, what we came up with was the doing the road work, getting into the new part of the Brown Park property. We'll clear the site for the campground area. We'll construct 19 campsites with tables and fire pits. This roadway and campsites will all be in a gravel at this time. The only paved work that would be done on the roadway would be what would be on the steeper part of the hill coming into the campground itself. Then we'd also supply one camp host site for an on-site resident host. And then we would tie the campground into the existing trails that go out through the Brown Park property. And then later on, come back to do other improvements or other opportunity grants, the development of the water system, the paving throughout the park, and other improvements that were laid out in our additional phases of this project. So I have went ahead and included this in next year's budget to carry the matching fund amount forward. And then upon approval of this document, we would send it back to the state parks. They would go ahead and assign it, and then we would get the full package back and then get the letter to proceed.
Questions?
I see. Yes. I see it says that the project would be completed by March 31st, 2020. So if it is funded, do you see the work happening this summer or next summer?
What we would start this summer was the finalization of the construction plans for the roadway. Mm-hmm. We would be working with Steve Hodges up on the hill at the Public Works office. And then we would start with the clearing of the property. Basically, when you get one of these county opportunity grants, you have a two-year project window to do. So that gives us two construction seasons this summer and next summer to get it complete. The target would be have everything completed by October of 2019.
Great.
Any other questions? All right. I believe we have a consensus to move forward.
Yes.
We need
yes.
Council Belmont,
This is a discussion item today, so we'll bring this back to you next week with an order to move forward.
Okay.
Great.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Keith.
All right. Thank you.
Good work.
All right. Next is a discussion information item on a transit plan, transit development plan, and we have a couple of presenters. Welcome. Please identify yourself.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Susan Wright. I'm with a consulting firm called Kittleson & Associates. Our office is in Portland, Oregon, and I've been working with Cinda.
Good morning, Commissioners. I'm Cinda Bruce, Program Director of Lincoln County Transit. We've actually been working on this transit development plan now for nearly 2 years. Susie Wright has been the lead consultant with Kittleson, who's been working with us on this. So I'm going to turn this over to Susie to give the presentation, and if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer afterwards.
Go ahead.
Great. All right. Well, I think you had my presentation in your packet, so I'm going to try to move relatively quickly since we have a full agenda this morning. But this is a discussion item because the actual plan will need to come back before you for adoption. I don't see it in the packet, but I do believe you received access to the full report.
Yes, we did. We all get it electronically.
Excellent. So I'm just going to give you a little bit of background just about the plan development process, what's in the plan, and what some of the next steps are. So as Cinda mentioned, it's been not quite 2 years. Our first engagement with an advisory committee was last March, so we've been working with an advisory committee for a little over a year, but started the background work, and Cinda did a lot of work conducting a lot of surveys of riders that did start in the fall of 2016. This gives you a little bit of an idea of our process. So in developing the plan, it was a multi-step process of collecting information and doing outreach and surveys, preparing technical memorandums, meeting with an advisory committee to get their feedback before moving forward. So you can see we had a series of 5 meetings with them, going over everything from existing conditions to goals to looking at future land use plans and what are the needs for transit to serve, coming up with an evaluation framework, discussing service alternatives, coming up with a monitoring program, going back out for another round of rider input, as well as just providing some opportunities for general open houses. And this has led to us coming forward to you today with a draft transit plan. So some of our questions and purpose for coming before you today is to try to understand from you if you believe that this plan is going to meet the needs of the community today and into the future, and if you have any kind of questions or requested modifications before this comes before you for adoption. Just a little kind of quick understanding of the system, although I'm guessing you guys are fairly familiar with it. The existing services provided by Lincoln County Transit include they partner in a Costa Valley route to Corvallis. They have 3 intercounty routes that center point here in Newport, going heading north to Lincoln City, heading south to Yahuts, and east to Siletz. There's 2 city loops, one in Newport and one in Lincoln City, and as well as dial-a-ride services in both Newport and Lincoln City. They serve about a little over nearly 320,000 riders a year, over 500,000 miles, and over 30,000 driver hours. They take in their annual kind of expenses and revenues are near $2 million, and the agency is, along with all transit agencies around the state, in a very good position to be anticipating some additional funding through the most recent state transportation bill that will, over the next couple years, phase up to about an extra $1 million per biennium. So
per
it's a great
biennium or per year.
Because originally, wasn't the state saying like $850,000 per year? But recently, Cindy, you told me that their projections were over optimistic. It looks
yes.
like more like 500,000 per year or $1 million per biennium.
Okay. Yeah.
do the rulemaking the exact way the formulas are being done and the different categories of funding. It's still kind of being worked out. But yes, definitely a sizable, good opportunity for increased service over the next few years. And that is a revenue stream that will be permanent. It doesn't have a sunset. However, we always have risks of the amount of funding coming from other state as well as federal funding sources is uncertain. So this lease is, although it looks like a near-term, potentially long-term increase, we know it's stable. Many of the other sources, we don't have necessarily that same confidence that they'll remain stable.
Before you go on, since I've interrupted, could you detail what the Costa Valley route is for people that may not know?
Sure. The Costa Valley route begins in Newport, and it's an intercity route that goes to Corvallis and hits the regional medical center there, and then on to the Amtrak station. We provide
in
Albany. Thank you. We provide 2 round trips, and we partner with Benton County, who also provide 2 round trips. So there are 4 per day. 7 days a week. So there are 4 round trips 7 days a week on that service.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
And ridership is increasing.
All right. So the document's about a 90-page plan that helps the reader understand the plan development process, existing and future conditions, and so forth. But the meat of the document is Chapter 5. Which is really where it's on page 74. So it's really about 20 pages or so that really constitutes the plan. It includes both an implementation plan, recommendations for marketing, monitoring performance, longer-term capital needs, financial plan, and service alternatives. So Lincoln County Transit's mission is to provide essential public services in efficient, effective, and respectful manner. And so this plan is really to help Lincoln County Transit implement that vision over the next 20 years. The plan includes both short-term actions, which we a time frame for us, short-term is kind of 0 to 5 years, as well as medium-term actions, which are looking more out 10 years. But we talk about the plan being a 20-year plan and that we were really looking at forecasts for population and land use out 20 years to make sure that the kind of near-term and mid-term plans were in alignment with that. But the most specificity is really in that less than 10-year time frame as far as service recommendations. So for the short term, So for the short term plan, it has recommendations really to just build from what is there today, but some of the highest needs being increased service hours and increased frequency on the existing routes, as well as moving to 7-day-a-week service, so providing service on Sundays. There's also recommendation for developing some system-wide service guidelines to help monitor performance, and we also do have a few route modifications. So for those route modifications for the short term, as I said, again, these are really just kind of doing some fine-tuning based on all the outreach that we did and what might be helpful to riders. For the East County route, making the Fred Meyer and Safeway and Walmart regular stops for all runs. For some routes, those are call stops. Making some modification in Sillettes as they have some new roads and some changing land use patterns, and we think working with them to change the routing in Sillettes would be a benefit to that community. And we also have some recommendations for routing changes in Toledo. For the North County route, really the primary recommendation is increased frequency. For South County, the near-term recommendation is to add a connection to the Oregon Coast Community College. And on the Costa Valley, it's to increase frequency or provide more runs per day at later or earlier hours, and to make sure that those routes are coordinating with Amtrak and Greyhound schedules. For the city loops, we have recommendation to if when the schedule modifications are occurring, to look for opportunities to accommodate Taft Elementary and High School start times. Look to operate 7 days a week and include some holidays. No short-term recommendations on the City Loop for Newport, although our long-term recommendations, which just depending on interest level from the city, could be implemented sooner. We definitely have some recommendations for changes in Newport. And then dial-a-ride, extended service hours, and 7 days a week service. The medium-term plan, continuing to add service as, you know, ridership funding and capital allows, and we have some recommendations on what those kind of next more significant changes to the routing might be. In Lincoln City, we looked at adding a second loop or second route and splitting the existing route to kind of bifurcate it in the middle, probably at the outlet malls, and then as part of bifurcating it, we can extend the length all the way out to Rose Lodge and all the way down to Salishan for the two bifurcated routes without them having such a long run time that creates kind of issues for reliability. The other alternative we looked at was creating a summer tourist loop, which would emulate a lot of the existing city loop, except it might remove some of the off-highway service that occurs around the lake and the hospital, and instead go off-route on some of the roads that along the hotel zone. And that would also need to extend kind of further north and south in the existing line. And that cost estimate is based on it only operating in peak season, about 3 months a year. And the benefit of that is that for most riders, not just tourists, it's going to be would be doubling the frequency of transit for the majority of the city. So the Newport City Loop, we've got recommendations to bifurcate that loop as well, and creating both a mostly maintain a north-south route and then create an east-west route that would directly connect Nye Beach to the bayfront. And provide, you know, easy time transfers at City Hall in one option, and another option has transfers available at both City Hall and Fred Meyer. And then there's definitely, we heard a lot of interest and need for extending dial-a-ride to additional cities. In particular, we heard it in Depot Bay, but as well as the others. So the management plan in the document includes a number of strategies to continue to partner with employers on coordinating service, increasing involvement with outside agencies, adjusting the fare policy to be a more simplified system, and consider monthly passes. Look for opportunities to expand the volunteer driver fleet, particularly for dial-a-ride services. There's driver union issues, but other transit agencies have had some success, good success in using volunteer drivers for certain areas of their dial-a-ride service. Create a performance monitoring plan, continue to enhance coordination with the local partners, and strategies for continuing to focus on customer service and satisfaction. On the customer end, we want to look at consolidating some of the maps and brochures into a single user-friendly brochure, making sure that the agency is moving in a way to support mobile applications, continue to invest in driver training programs, and continuing to increase or improve dispatching and dial-a-ride operations and procedures. But none of this is to say that the agency is not currently doing really great things in all of these areas.
So just to confirm, there is a mobile application available now.
Yes.
But like one thing that's mentioned, and do I remember correctly from the document, that the technology is available. We don't have it yet, but for somebody who's like waiting, gets to their stop, if we were able to upgrade to this technology, they'd be able to say, oh, okay, the bus is running 5 minutes late, but I didn't miss it, that kind of thing.
Yes, I'm looking at very soon going into real-time app so that our customers will be able to track. Other programs have done that, and I've heard that their calls into dispatch for where's the bus or when's the bus going to be here have been reduced as much as 90%. So that's that would be a great benefit. The QR codes that we're using now will
I'm
just learning about them myself.
Some kind of a reader, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. And we're just getting ready to put some of those out. We're putting them on the new schedules that are being published. And when they punch on that, it'll take them to our website and our actual schedules. So we're hoping that as people become familiar with that, our cost for schedules will decrease and people will start using their smartphones. Almost everybody carries one. So we're really going to try to get people moving in that direction.
Excellent.
Thank you. So the plan also includes a performance management plan, which you can see here, a number of different areas which we've recommended metrics for tracking. I'm just going to show you a couple examples here, and these are really for just monitoring performance over time to make sure are we moving in the right direction on these areas that we care about. A couple examples, tracking the cost per mile for each of your service types. So this helps kind of track what those costs are over time. And when you show this graph, everybody is always interested, well, what was the price of fuel that year? So we've added that onto the chart just as an information point. You can see that there is some correlation to fuel prices, but not always. You can see in the last year, the cost per mile have been increased slightly on all routes, even though fuel is going down. And that relates to another measure, which has to do with the percent of the operations that is going to maintenance. And as your fleet ages, your cost for maintenance goes up. So we have another metric or chart that follows that as well. One other example is just watching the passenger trips and how that relates to fuel price. And you can see that also, there's not as much of a correlation as people would think. It has a lot more to do with the economy, which has a relationship to fuel prices, but mostly the economy is what drives transit usage. And not just that when the economy is bad, more people are riding transit. We also see a lot increased ridership in transit when the economy is good because more people are working and using the service to get to jobs. There's one other example of just monitoring the number of hours by route type. It's very interesting to see these kinds of things over time. So the capital plan in the document includes kind of recommendations for vehicle replacement, as well as recommendations for kind of facility planning and longer term needing to anticipate the need for small transit centers, I would say, in both Newport and Lincoln City, which there is the transit center in Lincoln City today is really near the Safeway. I would consider it near the Safeway. There's a lot of transfers going on at Safeway between various routes. But so more of a formal transit center in Lincoln City as well as Newport, as well as designating some other major transit stops such as the Lincoln City outlets for kind of additional amenities and continue to construct additional passenger shelters. So the financial plan we prepared does look at projections, changes in fare revenues, property taxes. We tried to forecast intergovernmental funds as well as other grant sources. So we looked at all these it's a multifaceted funding plan that the agency has. I have it? I was anticipating a different slide there. But I guess it's not there. But we did look at forecasting all of those things. We were anticipating incremental increases in property taxes as the assessed values go up 3% a year, as well as looking at some growth in the overall tax base as additional properties are constructed. So with that in mind, we came up with a short-term financial plan that included anticipating the, kind of this list of the near-term recommendations. Moving to 7-day a week service, adding a little bit of time to several of the routes to make some of the recommendations that I went through. The most significant one being their increasing frequency on the Costa Valley, as well as the North County route and extending dial-a-ride service hours. So all of the short-term recommendations we put into a kind of financial plan for the next 5 years. And you can see that that we are anticipating with that, this is including some of the increased funds from the STIF, from the State Transportation Fund, that there it should be feasible to implement these items over the next several years and still have higher revenue than costs, but that revenue really should be positive cash flow should be really deposited for some of the recommendations and anticipating, you know, fleet turnover. So the medium-term financial plan, we've only included a few of the medium-term recommendations. So this is a list of all the medium-term recommendations, but the financial forecasts we did, we only included two of them. That was the Lincoln County tourist route, as well as additional dial-a-ride. We did not include the changes to Newport or moving to essentially a year-round second route in Lincoln City. Those would probably require kind of some additional funding above and beyond through the local partnerships. I will give you a little bit more detail on the Newport City Loop changes. That's the one that would benefit most from some visuals here. This map on the left is the existing Newport City Loop, and you can see it's primarily a north-south route, but around the center of town, it does loop around the Nye Beach area as well as to the bayfront. So our recommendations of moving to a two-route system in Newport would keep the majority of the north-south components of the existing route, but we've kind of removed the Nye Beach and bayfront portions and replaced those with a Nye Beach bayfront route. This example, the map on the left and the map on the right indicate the kind of southbound bus versus the northbound bus, where it would travel down Nye Beach, hit the bayfront, and then go to Fred Meyer, and then repeat. Then when it goes out to the north, it would just go up Nye Beach, and that would have transfers to the rest of the system, both at downtown as well as at Fred Meyer. And this could operate at a 45-minute headway. Another alternative that we looked at the City of Newport's request was looking at a 30-minute headway route, which would operate as two 15-minute loops, a 15-minute loop from City Hall to City Hall around Nye Beach, and then a 15-minute loop from City Hall to City Hall around the bayfront, which provides great connectivity to transfers at City Hall and also provides great service between Nye Beach and Bayfront. It doesn't provide that second opportunity to transfer at Fred Meyer. But I think both good options to be investigated further as we get closer to there's more interest around that. Those options. So the medium financial term financial plan, as I noted, doesn't include all of those recommendations, just a few of the summer service in Lincoln City and additional dial-a-ride. And you can see that this also kind of balances out in the 10-year time frame. The costs, the huge cost jump there out around 2023 has to do with a significant bus replacement that would be needed, which, as I mentioned before, any additional revenues over the next several years ought to be kind of saved in anticipation of that. So our next steps are really to We're hoping to hear from you. If you have any comments or questions or concerns about the plan, we want to make sure that we can address them before this plan comes back to you for your consideration.
Okay.
Thank
questions,
you.
Commissioner Hall?
Just comment and then maybe a question or two. As the commissioner who is the liaison commissioner for transit, I mean, we all serve as the transit district board and have an interest, but I've always tried to take a special interest in transit. I want to say I'm really impressed with this document, its depth and its breadth. I like the fact that it lays out a variety of options. And the question I'd have for Cinda, I guess, procedurally, if we do adopt it in this form or with some modifications, it's not really committing us necessarily to any of these specific changes. It's more laying out a whole menu of options dependent on funding. I mean, I think it called out, for example, the fact there's more options here than we can pay for by ourselves, but say if the city of Lincoln City, the city of Newport wants to step up and help pay for expanded service within their cities, then those things become feasible. Am I reading this all correctly?
That is correct. And another benefit to this plan is that the House Bill 2017 actually requires a planning document such as this, laying things out. It also calls for a committee with unspecified at this time representation, but those details are being worked out, and our options will be put forth to that committee, and they will have a lot of input, and I will take those recommendations to you, my board, as the final step, and that's kind of how the process will
flow. So in other words, before we get the extra $500,000 a year or whatever it ultimately turns out to be, we have to send them this plan. That's why we've developed and adopted the plan, and they have to sign off on whatever we decide to do with the extra money as well.
Yes, and there will also be application processes. It's not like they're just sending us some money. There are hoops all the way to jump through, because it's got to be very transparent, because we have to go back to the legislature and show them what we've done, and so they can
document the results
and hopefully continue the funding.
Good.
Thoughts? Again, I think the plan highlighted some areas that are of particular interest to me. Certainly, I think in improving the frequency of the routes, increasing the efficiency of the routes, I think are certainly important areas. But also, of course, I have an interest in economic development. I spend a lot of my time and energy in that area. And certainly, when you look at economic development, an effective transit system is a big part of that. It also, I think, addresses two of our major populations. 25% of our county is now 65 or older, so certainly I think the elderly are heavy users or heavier users of transportation, our transit, and the low-income families, individuals. So I think important things to note, and the services that are important to our citizens.
And low-income is going to, they're going to be placing a priority on low-income individuals. So for our county, I don't have a lot of justifying, just simply the census numbers kind of speak for themselves.
Yeah. But again, I think it helps that population.
Absolutely.
And addresses issues there. All right. Anything else?
Commissioners, maybe just one quick thing. You're taking comments. What's the process for people if they want to make comments?
Good point.
Anybody is welcome to submit comments through Cinda, and we will do our best to address them between now and when we come back to you.
Okay. And Casey, will there be a link on the website? Casey's nodding yes. So.
Okay.
Thank you, Casey.
All right.
And we have had a lot of opportunities. Like, this isn't like a last minute, what do you think? Mm-hmm. We've had many outreach efforts and forums and throughout the process. So I feel good about the outreach that we've we've completed.
Yeah, and there were some new things in here that I saw, but a lot of it reflected just kind of the informal feedback I've gotten, and I'm sure you have through the years as well, about people. They basically tell me they love the system, they just like more.
There were not a whole lot of surprises for me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. Before Cinda leaves, I have a question related to transit. Can you give us an update on the connection between Yahats and Florence?
Yes, I can. Let's see. Just a couple days ago, I received an update from the procurement office of Lane County, who has taken the lead on this project. They've put out an RFP, which is a request for proposals for an agency interested in providing this transportation. That deadline for the RFPs is April 16th. So once that's been determined, I believe it should start moving pretty quickly.
Okay. Good news.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I reported to the Yahats meeting. There was a lot of static people down there. They really need that.
Yes.
And I have to tell you that before I received that last email, I actually thought the project was dead because of the funding cycles and nothing being done. But I'm guessing they probably got an extension on it, and there will be the pilot project.
Mm-hmm. Good news.
Excellent.
All right. Thank you both.
Thank you. And thank you, Terry, for updating the Yahats Council on that for me.
Thank you. All right. We now move to reports. And the first report is the Lincoln Soil and Water Conservation District. And Aaron is coming forward. For the record, Aaron.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Aaron Duzik. I'm the Invasive Species Control Program Manager for the Lincoln Soil and Water Conservation District. So fiscal year 2016-17, I believe you guys contributed to the program to help protect some of the more sensitive natural resources in the county, and I just wanted to give you guys a brief summary of what we were able to accomplish. And so I gave you the one pager of what's generally goes on through a field season, which is generally the field season for treating invasives is somewhere between about May through October. We have a kind of a niche system that we coordinate with the county. Chris Cornwell over in the roads department, he does a lot of uplands work. So the roads and stuff that's not very close to water, and since we kind of tend to look after water quality issues, I take care of the different vectors around the wetland and streams of our county. This is a pretty 2016. This is the budget for the calendar year, and that's pretty typical. Invasive Species Control Program generally functions with an annual budget of somewhere between about $70,000 and $100,000, which employs about 1.7, 1.9 full-time equivalent positions. It's basically me and two seasonal employees that are normally working from, like I said, about May to October, depending on what the workload is for the year. We are completely soft-funded with grant funds, so the program is very results-driven. If you guys want to get into the weeds, so to say, of the numbers, I have very very exact metrics of all the different species that we treat and exactly where they are and how much we treat of them. Anyways, I just wanted to give you guys a quick update, answer any questions, and then, of course, with Congress not particularly looking like the reauthorization of the Secure Rural Schools Act is in the immediate future. I have to sometimes diversify where I get funding for the program as well. I don't like to come to you guys every single year, but I was going to state if you guys could find it in your budget development to help us out again for fiscal year 18-19, we would greatly appreciate it and put the funds to good use.
Well, let's put that in for discussion for sure. This is really important work, and I think we all know that.
So, I guess my question in this is, it's such a big problem over all the different species. Are we making progress? I mean, if we're going to pump something, I want to show some progress. Can you give me a breakdown on knotweed, gorse?
Yeah, absolutely. So I can... I can attest to more of the more aquatic-based species or riparian area invaders such as knotweed. We started a new integrated program 2010. Originally, going through all the numbers from the program's initiation 2010 to 2018, there was somewhere between about 21 to 23 net acres along the waterways and riparian areas. Of knotweed infestation in Lincoln County is somewhere between 1 and 3 now. And so it's kind of in a more of a management stage. We've eradicated throughout those 9 years of treatment. I have somewhere between 1,600 and 1,700 different knotweed infestation sites. About 800 of those have been eradicated, or what we consider to be, that we haven't witnessed it coming back in a few years. It is a complex species, but it's, you know, I don't know if you guys have floated down the salmon or the lower Yahats River anytime lately. It definitely is not looking like the Nehalem if you've been up there or whatnot. There's not these huge swaths of exotic invasive species covering our riparian areas anymore.
You can stop there. You've already built your case.
To take it just a little bit further, if you don't mind, one of the things that I've been really trying to concentrate on with the program is not just the control or stopping of the invasives. It's to actually get those ecosystems functioning properly again. And so in a lot of those cases where there were large infestations of knotweed is we've gone back in, since they're controlled, and planted as many native species as possible to get that that habitat and that ecosystem operating as it should, improving water quality.
Too deep into this, but I wanted to highlight what the investment does for you if we go to the county. So that's adequate. That's what I wanted to hear.
Certainly seems like we're getting $8,000 worth of
the yeah, I'd say results. Most counties are not accomplishing that.
Mr. Chair, if I may. Aaron, great report, and thanks for this information. And I think this just maybe would give us an opportunity, again, without having to go too deep into the weeds, pun intended, that even though I think both the county and the district for a long time really, as you say, have been leaders in responsible control practices, when I interact with the public, you know, I find a lot of people have gotten that message, but some people still think we're stuck in the 1970s and it's spray first and look at other methods later. So could you just give people kind of the high-level view of what the range of practices are and how you deal with these invasives?
Yeah, absolutely. It's generally species-specific when it comes to the most efficient and effective tool that you have in your toolbox. So with the knotweed species, I'll take that as an example because we were talking about it earlier. It reproduces vegetatively, and it has a complex root system where manual control efforts or mechanical control efforts only cause it to spread. And the type of habitat that it does infest, which is generally stream banks, it's not very conducive to take out an excavator and remove 30 yards of soil to, you know, control, you know, say 100, 200 square foot patch. So yes, you know, that we do have use chemicals, it's in the toolbox, but when you're talking about other species that don't require that, we go through the largest effort as possible. We are treating, controlling a species by the name of policeman's helmet, which is an impatiens that is an annual. It has very weak cellular composition and very shallow roots, and I would say that's probably a 50-50 mix of chemical versus manual control, because by the time we hop out of the kayak and go to pull, I mean, you know, even grab a backpack or a pump spray or something along those lines, you know, two guys can just whip through a patch of just yanking all that stuff, and that way we know we got every single stem that was there. It's a little bit more precise, and it's just not worth it to take out the guns for when you're, you know, treating a lot of smaller patches.
So, okay. Can I give you a suggestion for the next time you come back?
Yes.
If you have information like on knotweed about what the progress is, can you give us just a thumbnail sketch of how many acres of different types of things you see out there in the county? So we don't have a perspective of what you do because we're not in the field. And I don't want you to go out and create anything that you're not already doing, but if you have the information, bring it in, and then also discuss a little bit about what the spray level is, because in this county, spraying is a very controversial issue, or whatever the type of eradication measures you use, so that we can use it to the public to talk about what you're doing, and also we've done some discussion with the road department, but I think that kind of information given to the public to realize that we are trying to minimize it in this county, but we needed to remove or contain some of these species.
Good point.
Yeah, I think general public would be amazed at the lack of, or the little amount probably, that the road department and my program actually applies, and how much we are able to cover with our minimal application amounts.
Great numbers to have.
Are you a maps guy or a pie chart guy?
You bring it however
whatever
you
works.
Think is the best for you.
As long as it's visual.
Yeah.
Right. For me.
Maybe
for me.
Okay.
Commissioners, can I ask one question of Aaron? Just
yes.
Since, and I think I hear a consensus to do a placeholder in the proposed budget for some funding, or at least we'll have that as a discussion.
Yes, absolutely.
And, okay.
I agree.
Absolutely. I'm just curious that you know, this was Title II funding, the Forest Service, which is the bulk of your funding there. Have you gotten any indication at all whether or not there's going to be any kind of Forest Service funding next year? Because that really is the program, and then we supplement that.
So there are other avenues, yeah, or other doors into Forest Service funding as well, besides Title II.
Yeah.
I haven't had to explore those yet, but I do work with a lot of the folks down in the Forest Service quite closely. They have an interim botanist at the moment on the site use law, and when they're able to fill that position, then I think we'll be able to feel each other out a little bit more and figure out how we can partner up on a lot of the different vectors and kind of find out the responsibilities. Because when you're a manager, the people tend to know a little bit more about the fiscal impacts that invasive species can take.
Okay. Thank you.
Good.
Thanks,
man.
Good report.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, next item on our agenda is a recycling update. Gentleman from Dahl. Okay. Come forward and please introduce yourselves.
Okay, I'm Chuck Lerwick with Dahl Companies.
Zach Dahl with Dahl Disposal.
And I wish we were here to spread sunshine and have a good story, but unfortunately we don't. We think since our last communication we had, we've had an increase in the recycling now from $84, $83 now. On last Friday we got a call, early in the morning, and it said, your price has gone up. It's $95. It's $94 and some change a ton for the recycling, so that's not good news.
That's the money that we
That's our the tipping fee.
For them to take it. At one point, they were actually giving us money.
Yeah, correct. Early fall, we were getting like $5 a ton. That wasn't covering the program, but in the rates that we've built, it was subsidized through that, and we were covered. But this has all been unbudgeted money so far, and we're looking at $15,000 to $20,000 a month hit our bottom line that's unbudgeted money, so we're bleeding.
So, you know, excuse me, go ahead, Michelle. You're first. I was going to say, just to clarify, you're talking about the cost that, or what you have to pay to deliver commingled recycling to a
processor.
It's now gone from, what, 84 to 94?
Yeah, it's almost 95. It's 84, 94 and some change. Overnight, and that really makes it tough because we do have our rates are coming, and we don't. It's like trying to hit a moving target while we're doing analysis and trying to figure out, you know, what we're going to do next. The price is ratcheting up and up,
and again, that $94 a ton is up from at one point you were actually being paid to deliver the commingled.
Correct. Yeah, and it was, like Chuck says, it was helping offset the costs to put the recycling programs on for our customers, so either at the curb or at the transfer station.
So I want to get a little bit deeper into this than just that, because all the information coming across my desk is that we were artificially doing the rates, the low rates, because we were shipping to China and they were taking things that really didn't make money and having poor people distribute it. Now all of a sudden we've stopped doing that.
Well, correct.
So fill me in. You guys are closer to it than I am.
Well, it's actually we didn't stop it. China did.
Right.
They have stopped writing purchase orders. There's been ships been floating around that wanted to come in and unload, and they won't accept the material. They have a percentage, what is it, 0.5 contamination level, which is impossible.
So they've came out with a... Sorry, Chuck.
Go ahead.
They've came out with a new program called National Sword, and basically what that is saying, hey, we don't want materials that we cannot utilize anymore. Right. And as you're speaking about, Terry, they don't want to take what we perceived as recycling. They don't want to take those materials because they were not efficiently recycling it themselves. So great documentary to watch is Plastic China. Yeah. Kind of gives some insight on that. So as Chuck said, they've actually asked all processors, all shippers, that if they bring material over to China, that it has a 0.05% residual rate in that bale of whatever it is, which is virtually impossible to meet for any processor. So virtually all material being shipped over there has stopped. As Chuck would say, it's kind of floating around in on barges. So
literally, we've been artificially using the recycling system to contaminate a third world country. Am I correct on that?
Well, let's say true.
Yeah. Maybe not intentionally, but
we as a country were artificially thinking that we call it the magic blue bin, that you could just lift the lid and whatever you put in there was going to be recycled. And I've been doing this would be 42 years in the industry, and I'm guilty of it. I'd have customers call and say, well, I've got this. What do I do with it? And I said, well, if you put it in your trash can, it's going to go straight to the landfill. But, you know, if you think it, you know, the plastic clamshell things and stuff like that back in the day, I said, well, if you put it in the blue bin, it's going to go across the line, and it may be recyclable. But if not, well, then they can throw it away. At least it has a second chance. And that was some really bad information.
So let's not look at it all negatively.
Correct.
I mean, what was going on is the public was feeling good about getting rid of all this stuff. But if you look at this thing long term, I want to see if you agree. Because we're going to raise the rates, there's going to be a lot more research into how to utilize these other products. And we're going to go through this period of having trouble until we can figure out what we should do is responsibly handle our own garbage and create things from it.
And we haven't done the research because it was so economically feasible to send this to China. So actually, short term, there's going to be a lot of people upset. But long term, I think we're going to be a more responsible nation instead of just passing it off to a third world country.
Correct, Terry. I think you're going to see... what you're going to see is a change. So what we're doing right now is cleaning up the recycling. So we're cleaning up the recycling to have a sustainable material that can be reused. So the items now that you can put in that blue cart or take to our recycling station can now be reused. We all know cardboard can be reused. We all know tin and aluminum cans can be reused. We know newspaper, magazines, and junk mail can be reused. We know plastics 1 and 2, something with a neck on it, can be reused. And those are the items that are now going into the blue bin, where the items that were questionable, such as plastics 3 through 7, your clamshells, your people were putting plastic bags in there. Chuck has a story about dog hair. I mean, people were throwing everything in there thinking somebody could reuse it. So what we're doing is having to take the wishful recycling mentality, the feel good about putting it in that blue bin, and come to reality and say, we only can put what can be recycled in that blue bin, which in turn hopefully will create industries here or drive industries here to help recycle those materials. Right now we have a lack of those industries here, and there is actually a surplus of recycling material on the market because there is not enough demand here to take care of it all.
So let's talk 1 and 2. Mm-hmm. 1 and 2 is the ones that can be recycled, the 3, 4, 5 to 7. Won't that drive, if the responsible business owner that uses that product, won't that drive them to adapt their containers to 1 and 2?
Well, that's kind of interesting, Terry, because we all are in control of that as consumers. And that's where pre-cycling comes in. We've already started doing it at home. Instead of buying the nice margarine in the plastic tub, we buy it in the box with the paper on it. I mean, you got to pre-cycle, and we have to send a message to the manufacturers that when they send us something, we don't want a cardboard box full of garbage. If it's all packed with cardboard, we can recycle it all and get rid of the styrofoam and the fancy package. I was looking the other day, the big plastic clamshell thing was about this big, and it had a memory chip in it. You know, why does it have to be like that? But on your other statement there, was I was trying to be optimistic myself, saying, well, geez, you know, we've all the paper and stuff, you know, we should, you know, there should be some domestic markets. And then I'm listening to the news and they said the Camas mill just closed, you know, and you're just like, I think we're going to see maybe they're going to dust those off and open some of those back up. I hope that we can start having some more domestic recycling, because like you say, it was a cheap, easy, and we could feel good about it. Well, the bus has left the station on that.
So let me make one final comment. And this concerns me that a lot of people are beating up the haulers and those people. And it's not what you've done. It's what we have done as a society and went the cheapest way. And it's not just us, it's all countries in the world. I mean, Germany was selling, sending clear to China with some of their product. They ran into that. And the shippers were looking for backhauls. And that was one of the things that was the shipping companies needed backhauls. And this was a product they could make a little money on by transportation when they went to pick up other low goods to bring back this way. It's a worldwide problem. It's not our local haulers. It's not what... We need to address it as a country at a far higher level than here, but I wanted to ask you the question to see if we were in the same ballpark. It sounds like we are.
I sure appreciate that comment, Terry, because we have been getting beat up pretty bad, and that's thank you for that comment.
Yeah, I appreciate it. The messenger.
Thank you.
The message. We want to help you get out.
And we're the ones echoing that message. And Terry, thank you. We appreciate that because we have caught a lot of flack, and we're doing our best to get the message out to consumers, but it's changing so quickly that we want to make sure we get the right message out. And if we don't get the right message out, it causes more confusion. So I think one great question is, what can go in the blue bin? And we're focusing on that as a company. Not what cannot, but what can go inside that bin, so we can tell people what that is. We've got a flyer here if anybody wants that. Just had those. They came in late last night. We're getting some more, and we're going to do quite a big education campaign again to our customers. But some more thought on consumer activities and what we can do as consumers, Terry, to follow up with that. You know, if you find sustainable packaging or a company that has sustainable packaging, write that company. Thank them. If you find a company that is not using sustainable packaging, write them. It's going to take us as consumers to change the way those companies are putting materials in something to ship to us or to sell to us, because you know it's scales of economy. They're doing business. They have to look at every cost that's associated with it. And sometimes doing the right thing costs a little bit more than packaging in something that's easy, that's non-reusable. So we're encouraging, when we went and sat in front of our municipalities and spoke, we're encouraging everyone to just kind of do what Chuck's doing, pre-cycle, and look at those packages that you're buying. Find the ones that are good and spend a quarter more on, you know, bringing your own bags to grab the spinach that's not in a plastic container that costs a little bit more. Those things will help us force change with industry. So,
any questions, comments?
Nope.
Again, I think really we're talking about changing the behavior of the consumer. And if you go back to the early years of recycling, people didn't recycle. Everything went in the garbage.
Oh, I was there.
Yeah, and so you know, slowly you create an awareness of recycling, of the value of recycling, of the benefits to our society of recycling. And now, frankly, as Commissioner Thompson pointed out, because China said they're tired of buying the world's garbage, now we've got to change that consumer behavior again, and I think you've both made excellent points as to actions that can be taken to help change the way packages are packaged and the decisions that the consumer can make. And hopefully there'll be some industry that's created that now says, gee, we've got some opportunities here. So it's a complicated situation, but yeah. I think there's reasons to be optimistic.
One last comment. Our university system, our education system, our research system is grant-driven. And because of the way it was going, we weren't investing in it. But it takes Congress now and people to start requiring some research into this area so that we can use the other stuff that doesn't make the type of our garbage that we can reuse. It's, I know we have an ability to, I think, be original in our thinking in this country, and this is a great place to start.
Yeah, we can send men to the moon and cameras to Mars. You would think we could take care of that.
Solar system.
Yeah. But I mean, you're absolutely right. We only have so much earth and so much air, and we're going to fill it all up with garbage eventually. I'll be dust by then, but you know, it's us now that are going to make the difference for the future. And
maybe I'm going to wind up in a garbage can.
I don't want to end this conversation on a negative point because I think there are a lot of positives. But I also think in an effort to be transparent, because your costs have gone, or recycling handling has gone from a revenue source to an expense, I think we can expect to see some increases in the cost for curbside garbage, trash handling, that sort of thing. So, again, I think we understand why, and we'll wait for additional information.
Yeah, and there is this, it does put upward pressure, and we, you know, I wish we could just go forever and not have to raise rates, but we have to be able to pay the bills and, you know, have capital money to buy new equipment and things like that. But we've had to be really cautious with this, Doug, because it's like a shooting gallery watching the ducks go by. You know, we don't know what it is yet, and it's going to it's going to be an interesting endeavor to try and do it, because we want to be fair and equitable to our customers. And
correct. And Doug, you know, ending on a positive note, I think that that's the way to go, and that's what we have to think about. We still can recycle 90% of what went in that bin originally. We're taking out less than 3-5% of what was put in that bin, or cart, I should say, the blue cart, which is plastics number 3 through 7. We're asking consumers to also take out the garbage that they're putting in there. And that's what we're doing. We're asking people to just clean it up. 90%, we got is plastics 1 and 2, cardboard, tin and aluminum cans, newsprint, junk mail, and magazines can still go in there. If you think about it on just that level, we're still recycling 90% of what we did before. It's just we have to change our mentality that the magic blue bin is not magical.
And just to clarify on what can go in the bin, because I'm a customer of Dolls, full disclosure, I asked you, I said, what about shredded paper? And because I shred most of my junk mail, but I understand that shredding breaks down the fiber and the paper, and therefore shredding the paper, you cannot recycle it.
It destroys the value of it.
Correct. You know, paper grocery bags can be recycled.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yes, they can go in the blue cart, their cardboard product.
Okay. Any other questions, comments?
No. Commissioners, just a note that, you know, we've had these same conversations with the other two franchise haulers in the county. Informally, they're going to come in and talk to you, too. And I anticipate that everyone's going to be in this year for rate discussion. So we're working on setting up a schedule to get those in front of you, too.
And the one thing we didn't touch on is April 1st, there will be a $15 charge at the Recycle Depot if you are coming in just solely using the transfer center, because we've got a lot of people that come up and use that, and they're not customers, and they're not really helping offset anything. So if you, I see Doug up there.
I'm up there more than once a week usually.
Yeah, so what we have is our customers, if you are a self-hauler, if you come in with a load of trash, and I've been talking to people all week, well, for the last 2 weeks, if you are a self-hauler, bring the recycling with your trash. You'll be weighed in. You can get rid of your trash and your recycling at the gate rate for the trash and not have to pay an additional $15. And also for customers that have, like, we just had somebody started up service and they moved in and they had all their moving boxes and the brown paper and stuff. So we're going to allow you to come up as a customer and use that for free for 3 times to come up. And glass is always going to be free. And so we're trying to make it as easy as possible. What we're trying to do is just have the folks that are utilizing it, that everybody chips in to pay, because it just wasn't fair to have people using it and not contributing anything. It just wasn't fair to everybody else. So that will be starting on April 1st as well.
All right. Okay. Anything else? All right. Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Okay. Thank you.
We have a report now on Part 5 litigation opinion. Council Belmont, Council
David
Allen.
Commissioners, I'm going to make a couple of quick comments here and then turn it over to David.
Sure.
This is a long time coming. David will talk a little bit about the length of time and the amount of effort that was put into bringing this particular litigation to fruition. And I'd first like to thank David for representing the petitioners in this matter. And the two petitioners that actually came forward that really made this happen, who were David Yamamoto and Charles Seiko. And as you may recall, I'm not going to spend too much time on it because I think you're very familiar with it. This was a challenge to Part 5 of the Territorial, an amendment to Part 5 of the Territorial Sea Plan dealing with wave energy. We were concerned with the process that the Land Conservation and Development Commission used to reach their final decision, and we felt there were some errors that were made. David identified those errors and very ably presented those to the court, and bottom line is prevailed. We were involved because we saw what was going on. We talked to David about the litigation here and felt this was of importance to the entire coast. And it's really about the Territorial Sea Plan and the process to both develop the plan and amend it. So We sought the permission from all the coastal counties. That includes Clatsop, Tillamook, Lincoln, of course, Douglas, Curry, and Coos, and then we also got a letter of support from Lane County to file a friend of the court brief, an amicus brief, to support the position that David took there and also do explain why it was important to us as coastal communities. End result, a decision invalidating the rule and the process that was used by the state. And David will explain what happened with that result. I just want to note a couple quick things. I was pleased to see the court talk about the special relationship between the Ocean Policy Advisory Council, OPAC, and our role as communities in OPAC, and the development and the amendment of the sea plan. That was important for us to have the court recognize that interdependent relationship. I think that was extremely important. Also, I was pleased to see that the court said that the state agency tried to, in this case, LCDC, tried to argue that they really had authority beyond the process to establish the plan in which to make the changes, which they did. And the court said, no, this is the process you have to use. So I think those were two important points that the court recognized they played into part of the discussion they had in reaching a decision. But it's a great decision. David and I have talked about a couple of next steps, and I'm going to let him talk about what those are, and let's see where we can go from here. David?
Thank you for that introduction, Wayne. David Allen, P.O. Box 1321 here in Newport. Thank you for allowing me to appear this morning. And Chair Hunt, you did say Councilor Allen, and I am a city council member, but today I'm here in my capacity as the attorney representing the petitioners, Charles Seiko and David Yamamoto. But I have participated in ocean planning as a council member, so there is kind of an overlap there.
Due recognition where it's warranted.
Yeah, that's right. But I just need to make that clear that I'm here on behalf of petitioners. That's just one of the things that I needed to do. So Wayne, thank you for that overview. I'll be presenting this memo. So today you have in front of you, we didn't get into the council packet online, but I assume it's going to be posted online eventually. There's a memo that I prepared dated March 20th, which kind of goes through some of the issues that I wanted to provide an overview on. And I also included a copy of the opinion, so that's part of the commission packet. And the case name is Seiko versus DLCD. That's going to be the formal title of the case. Citation is 290 ORF 655 2018, and the decision came down 2 weeks ago on March 7th. But it was a long time coming. I'll grant that, and I think Wayne and I can attest to all the time that occurred between when we filed the petition for review and when we got the result. So I'm, again, here primarily as the attorney representing, but, you know, I spent nearly 13 years on the Ocean Policy Advisory Council. I ended my second, I guess, two-plus terms as of December of last year. And 9 of those years, I was the vice chair of OPAC. And I was also the chair of the working group that helped develop the Territorial Sea Plan Part 5 for the OPAC recommendation. So even though I'm representing the petitioners here as an attorney, I've got a lot of extensive involvement in the actual process that was undertaken, and that probably gave me some sense of how to proceed on this legal challenge once we found the need for it to occur. So with that perspective, I would just like to say this was an excellent result. This is what we were hoping for. And as Wayne noted, the court invalidated the rule adopted by the Department of Land Conservation and Development, which is known as Amended Part 5 of the Territorial Sea Plan. And they now need to address the next results of this outcome. And I'm not going to go into detail other than to say that the court opinion did a very nice job of laying out the background for this case and a very clear job of articulating the reasons why they invalidated the rule. So I think they did a nice job, and it was well articulated. And I think as people read through it, even though it's a legal opinion, there is a lot to be gained from reading it, because there's a lot of just standard overview background language that I think will be helpful as people become more familiar with this opinion. It's not a final opinion yet. As we all know, that if a Court of Appeals decision comes down, the party that was the on the losing side of the opinion can petition the Supreme Court for review, and they have 35 days to do that. Now, that review is discretionary, meaning the Supreme Court doesn't have to take the case. Now, the Court of Appeals takes most of the cases that are appealed to them because they're the appeal of kind of a first right. The Supreme Court's discretionary. Now, that 35-day timeline is going to be put on hold for a while because I filed a motion or petition with the court to get a couple issues clarified. So even though it's a final opinion, it won't be truly final until something happens with respect to either a petition being filed and denied or the timeline for the parties who have the ability to file a petition for review decide not to do so. So maybe next month or in May we'll know for certain what the issue is on that. So I just Wayne and I felt it was important just to kind of go over how long this process has taken from the legal challenge end of things. It took 5 years to put this plan together from 2008 to 2013. Once the rule was filed with the Secretary of State's office in October of 2013, I undertook representation at that point. Well, actually, I undertook representation earlier than year, but at that point, after the rule was filed, we filed a petition for judicial review in January of 2014. It took a year to put together the agency record. It was 1,250 pages, and the attorney for the Department of Justice commented to me right before our argument that this is one of the largest records she's ever seen on a rulemaking procedure. So she was really interested in this case for that reason alone, because it took so long to put the record together. And I would also note that the record, for anyone that wants to know the history of this rulemaking procedure and the history of Part 5 and the wave energy facility siting issue that's before us, can go to that record and they'll see exactly the history behind this rulemaking process. So after the record was settled, we filed our opening brief in May of 2000. Well, the record was settled in May of 2015. We filed our briefs later that year. Wayne, on behalf of the Coastal Counties, filed his amicus brief. There was another participant as amicus, and that was an amicus brief filed by GCI Communication Corp., North American Submarine Cable Association, and Oregon Fishermen's Cable Committee, Inc., and I'm going to go into some discussions I had with their chair, Scott McMulliner, earlier this morning on that particular amicus brief and their role in this process. So, it was a long time coming. The reply brief that I filed to end the briefing occurred in May of 2016. They scheduled oral argument November of 2016. That was the last time I was before you with an update in December of 2016. And we waited a year and roughly 4 months for the decision. So what are the next steps? And I'd like to add one more thing. Wayne, you pointed this out as far as you were pleased with the court's recognition of the role of the coast in this process or coastal communities. I just want to point out some language that I pulled out of the court opinion that's in my memo that I think kind of summarizes it. On page 665 of the memo, it states that OPAC, quote, plays a critical role in ocean planning. And then the court further states, and I'm quoting the court, OPAC remains the primary means by which a large number of interest groups as well as the local coastal communities participate in the planning process. So the court recognized OPAC's important role in this process, which validated really what we were saying all along.
Let me finish, please.
I want to go into next steps, which will play into the commission.
Explain what OPAC is.
Okay.
The public, you're seeing.
I am not through with my presentation yet. So let me finish.
Let's get along.
Okay. So I'm going to finish and go into the next steps, and then Terry, you can weigh in, and you'll have all the ability to do so.
Could offer a comment.
I had a few more comments to make, and then I was going to open up for discussion. But let me just finish my final thought.
The public doesn't understand what OPAC is. Would you explain that for the public, what it is?
Okay.
Terry, if you want to explain what OPAC is, feel free to do so.
I think that, let's just...
You have the floor, Commissioner.
If you want to explain what OPAC is,
Thompson has the
you're an OPAC floor. Member,
David.
Explain it.
Commissioner Thompson.
Quite simply, OPAC is Ocean Policy Advisory Committee is created by the governor's office to advise on ocean issues. It's Ocean Policy Advisory Committee.
Council.
That's all
Council.
It is so that it's
Council.
Advisory.
Council.
Advisory basis. But now, I wanted to say that because we need some more explanation of what this committee is, where this stuff goes. So would you do that?
Okay.
Thanks.
So. Thank you, Commissioner Thompson. And I will note that Commissioner Thompson and I have served together for over 13 years on the Ocean Policy Advisory Council, so we're very familiar with the process and with the council itself and how this process has moved along, not only in the past but into the future. But I will note that if you want an explanation, not just verbally, but of what OPAC is, As I said earlier, you can go to the court opinion on page 662, and it lays it out very nicely and very specifically. But in generalities, the Ocean Policy Advisory Council, and this could take a long time, but I'll be brief, was formed back in 1991 by the legislature to help advise state agencies, local governments, and local stakeholders here on the coast on ocean planning and management issues. And that role has been pursued by OPAC for roughly 27 years. Now, there have been various members on OPAC over time, but there was a new OPAC, and I went into this in December of 2016, and I know the News Times did a nice article on this, but just to review what I went over back in December of 2016 again, OPAC did change its composition in 2003, and the coastal communities, through the legislative change, were given more of a prominent role in the decision-making process as voting members. And that change was critical in 2003 to what occurred with the Part 5 process that we challenged and ultimately prevailed upon. So OPAC, Ocean Policy Advisory Council, really is the role, is as the court noted, is the group that really should be at the center of how ocean planning is undertaken by the state of Oregon, including the state agencies, the governor's office, and really in partnership with the local governments and coastal communities work on those issues. So, again, there's a lot that can be said about OPAC. Terry, is there anything else? I mean, feel free to add into some your perspective on the Ocean Policy Advisory Council, if you'd like to add to that.
It's what I think was intended to be the highest council committee to discuss ocean issues, to help the agencies and the governor's office make decisions. And that was the purpose behind it, because at one time the agencies had the controlling votes in there. And it was a major legislative fight to create it so that the public and we had local people involved instead of just going strictly to the agencies patting down decisions.
So along the lines of what Terry and I just provided as far as the OPAC composition and the history of OPAC, I want to point again to what the court said on that same page 665, right above the language I just quoted earlier. And this is the court basically's conclusion on the statutory interpretation and OPAC's role in this ocean planning process. Quoting the court, even though DLCD, the Department of Land Conservation and Development, is the state entity, quote, designated as the primary agency for coordination of ocean resources, end of quote, its relationship to OPAC is not one of simple hierarchy where the commission controls, and the commission in that case would be the Land Conservation and Development Commission, whose rule we challenged. Rather, the relationship involved is more complex, with DLCD assisting OPAC, which in turn advises the commission. So the whole point of this legal challenge was that when we, and I say we because Terry and I were both OPAC members when this recommendation was made, when OPAC made its recommendation after a five-year public outreach process, last minute, and I mean last minute, literally on some issues, the agency changed the OPAC recommendation to fit what the agency wanted to do based on input probably from that point in time, the governor's office. So there was a lot of behind-the-scenes discussion going on after OPAC's recommendation. So in that way, the agency thought that they, the agency, I think, probably felt that we on OPAC assisted the agency. I mean, that's the way it kind of turned out because they changed OPAC's recommendation, and that was the final recommendation they presented. But the court kind of said, no, agency, OPAC doesn't assist you. You assist OPAC. And that language is critical. It's one sentence, but it really says it all. And I think that's a really important point to make. And, well, again, Terry, I know we've had our back and forth, but I think over time, you and I, along with a few others, we have worked, I think, really well together on coastal issues. And I think even though we have a different approach, I think most of the time, and I say this genuinely, and I've said this to you before in private, you and I have agreed on most every issue of importance that we've had to deal with on OPAC. And I think here on the coast, it's important to have a unified voice.
I agree with you 100%.
It's like having a fisherman and a lawyer fight for which one wins.
Yes, exactly. But the fact that we're both but the fact we both have strong personalities is good because we can bring that to the OPAC process when it's needed. So, anyways,
it really was needed in this situation.
Well, anyways, but I feel comfortable doing that because we've served together and we've participated together, Terry and I, in hundreds of meetings. So I know Terry as well as probably any other public official in the county. So I'll just say that. And I say that in a nice way because I appreciate the input he's provided over the years. And I'm not sure what he's going to say about me, but I'll leave that for another day. But
So where are we now?
Okay, so this is what I spoke to Wayne about. I think since we put all the work, meaning the counties and the other amicus participants, into invalidating this rule, we should have a prominent role in what happens next. Now, I think the commission would probably like to have control again and decide, well, now what do we do with this opinion and have LCD? I'll say commission, the Land Conservation Development Commission. Yeah. The court uses the word commission, so yeah. I'll use the acronyms, LCDC. So LCDC is probably now going to be advised, and I'm not sure, at one of their future meetings coming up, how to handle this court opinion, whether they're going to challenge it or how they're going to handle sending this back down or revisiting it. And they're going to get advice from their legal counsel, from the Department of Justice, and the only thing I can say is they need to get advice from their legal counsel and from the agencies. But the last time they got advice from their legal counsel and agencies, they were wrong because we prevailed on the legal challenge. So I think they need to be careful about what kind of legal advice they're getting if five years ago it was not the correct legal advice. So I'm only cautioning for the record that they need to be careful and weigh in on this with other opinions. So we can provide that other alternative opinion. So Wayne and I brought this to Wayne's attention this morning, have come up with a potential next step. I think, and this is in my memo, that the agency made all the required findings under that statute that they had to comply with respect to the OPAC recommendation. We said this in the briefs. The county said this in their brief. There's no reason why the OPAC recommendation cannot be adopted by the commission at this point in time. Because all the required findings were made. That would be clean, that would be efficient, and it would kind of, OPAC wouldn't have to worry about it. They have a lot of other things on their plate right now. There is a couple issues, and the person I spoke with, Scott McMullen, said it was okay to mention this. I spoke with Scott this morning, who manages the Oregon Fishermen's Cable Committee. Terry's very, very familiar with that organization. There's one issue that they were concerned about, and these were the amicus participants, GCI Communication Corps, North American Submarine Cable Association, and Oregon Fishermen's Cable Committee. And that was the language that the agency deleted. Literally last second, the day of the hearing, they deleted language that had been worked on for 5 years. And that had to do with when there's an undersea cable that is already in a spot and a wave energy facility wants to site in that area, the language we recommended at OPAC was that company had to get the agreement by that authorized prior user before they could site them. Now, last minute, the state said, well, that might be a delegation of authority issue, and we may not be able to do that under the Constitution. So there's an issue there separate from the statutory consistency requirements that's constitutional. And there might be a point that the state made that needs to be resolved further. And I spoke with Scott McMullen earlier today, and Scott said that if we want to move forward, and this gets to my suggestion, and Wayne supported it, and I'll kind of leave Scott aside for now, but I think we should do a letter to LCDC and copy OPAC jointly, me on behalf of the petitioners, and Wayne can start drafting it on not only behalf of the commission, but all the coastal county commissions up and down the coast, the ones that joined on the amicus brief, a letter indicating what we would like to see the commission do, meaning LCDC, as the next step. So we kind of set the narrative. And I think by sending that letter, we're letting them know, hey, we won the legal challenge, but we're not going away. We want to make sure we hold you to accountability. So, Wayne, you want to weigh in on maybe what you think would be appropriate from your end of things and putting that letter together with the other legal counsels up and down the coast? Or I mean the county councils?
I like this. I think it's a good idea. I think it's actually a positive step. It gives them a concrete next step, what to do, how to resolve this particular issue. So I like it. I will say this, and I had to laugh, David, because I went back and was looking this morning. When we started the litigation, there was different attorneys in like four of the counties. So I have to kind of re-educate some of the attorneys, the county council, if they're new to the process here. They weren't involved in the initial. But, you know, you had the Board of Commissioners in every one of these counties supportive of what we're doing, and I think this is a great follow-up. I like the idea.
And I spoke with Scott McMullen this morning because he was the point person on the other amicus brief with the issue that was more about the agreement by the authorized users. And I think a separate letter from those amicus participants would be worthwhile, because it's not only a second letter, and sometimes two letters sends a more powerful message than one letter, but there's some different issues that they're speaking to, and they might have some other issues they want to raise in their letter as a companion letter to our letter. And Scott said it would be fine to say on the record that he supports my suggestion in working with Wayne on a letter, and that and then Scott would coordinate with the other amicus participants on the undersea cable issue with them and work with us in creating a second letter as a companion letter. So, and that's a suggestion.
Can I jump in here and explain a little bit about
Commissioner Thompson?
The worldwide telecommunication system is, this is an important issue. This isn't just about our little fight here. It's the real big player in this was when the cables that handle your internet and all your services. We're the first place that came where there was a potential for a wave energy site or any other user to come in after they've given a route through the ocean and basically usurp the space they need to haul the cable back and repair it if there's damage. So it's a big deal for all of us all around the world that depend on the internet. This isn't just a little fight over some issue in the state and an agency. It's a lot bigger fight than people realize. And without giving that authority, it would potentially interrupt and cost lots of money to people all over the world. It's not just a little fight. This is a bigger, much bigger issue.
And I'll just to highlight that point, because I remember in December of 2016, I was reviewing, you know, that discussion, and I brought up the same point, and you highlighted the importance internationally. But when you look at the amicus participants on that particular brief we were talking about, GCE Communication Corp is out of Alaska, but it's a regional communication corporation. Oregon Fishermen's Cable Committee, Inc., kind of handles the siting issues here up and down the coast in Oregon. But the other amicus participant was the North American Submarine Cable Association. I mean, that association, and Terry, you can probably speak more to that association, that covers a wide range of interest groups.
It's all the players worldwide telecommunication.
And they felt it was important enough to join in on this amicus brief along with the counties in support of the petitioner's argument because, as Terry noted, the importance of that issue with respect to the telecom industry. So that was a good point to make, yeah, definitely. Anyways.
Yeah, it sounds like there are two issues. It sounds like the court decision is favorable relative to both issues, and it sounds like we've got Council Belmont will work on a letter that involves coastal counties that provides a recommendation.
I think, David, do we have a target date?
So here's what I suggest. Since we're going to put this letter in draft form, and I'm going to work with – I think the letter that Wayne puts together, I'll jointly participate in on behalf of petitioners. And as many of you know, David Yamamoto, who's listed as one of the petitioners, when this legal challenge was filed, he was an individual homeowner who was very active in Tillamook County. But since – talking about how much time has elapsed, he's now a county commissioner in Tillamook.
David will.
Yes. So, I mean, that shows how long this case has been going through the courts. But – I would like to jointly have one letter on behalf of petitioners and the counties, and then Wayne, the target date is to get it to OPAC for its April 26 meeting. So if we can get, if we can have this letter back before your commission here in the county for a final approval, if you think that's necessary, Wayne, then I would say probably in early April, so we can get it off to OPAC and to the LCDC, the Land Conservation Development Commission, because their next meeting, in which this will probably be an agenda item for them, meaning LCDC, is May 24th through 25th in Salem.
It sounds like we've got a plan.
And then I'll talk with Scott McMullen, and I'm sure Terry Wells also, since he knows Scott very well on these issues, and try and coordinate with Scott in doing a companion letter so we can submit those letters together in support of our next steps forward.
Okay. Very good.
Anything else? Scott McMullen was the Newport judgment.
Yes.
Lincoln County judge. He was my deckhand years ago, and now he's leading this international table committee that started years ago. He's really, really sharp and does a great job in the state of Oregon and looking at the worldwide futures.
And just because I want to highlight Scott's importance in this whole process. Not only is Scott handling these issues, you know, as a staff person for the cable committee, Scott chaired the Ocean Policy Advisory Council from 2005 until he had to, step down because of the end of his term last year. So Scott was the chair for 13 years on the Ocean Policy Advisory Council, and I served as vice chair with him for 9 of those years. So Scott's importance in this whole process covers a lot of different areas, and I just can't say enough about Scott. I said a lot about how much I appreciated him back at the last OPAC meeting, but I really think so highly of Scott. And I'm just not saying that. He's just a truly genuine, thoughtful person, and I just can't say enough about him. And I'm just going to leave it at that.
We wouldn't be in the same situation here in the state of Oregon making our independent decisions, and a lot of our collaborations come through him.
Yep.
All right. Well, good work.
Yep.
And we'll look forward to Council Belmont coming up with working with the other counties and coming up with a letter.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Take care out there.
I will. I'll try.
All right. Next we come to commissioner reports. Commissioners, who?
Pass.
Pass?
No, pass.
Well, I'm going to take... What?
It's a long meeting.
Well, I'm going to take a moment just to highlight the fact that I attended a meeting yesterday afternoon in Yahats. There was an Economic Alliance board meeting that really was an effort to get groups together and talk about removing the lines in the sand as far as jurisdictional issues and working together. And a couple of the projects that were highlighted, I thought, are great examples of collaborative efforts of multiple agencies. The scenic Highway 34 Scenic Highway is a project that involved really Linn County, Benton County, Lincoln County, and that moved forward where there was discussion about the Coast Trail and the different jurisdictions that have had to work together to get the Coast Trail. And there was some talk about RAIN, which is a project that our county has supported, but also working with Florence and Lane County. So some excellent examples of working collaboratively together and not worrying about lines in the sand. So with that, if there are no other commissioner comments, we'll move to constituent input. This is an opportunity for anybody to address the Board of Commissioners on any item of interest. And we ask you to limit your comments to no more than 5 minutes.
You've been here a long time.
Yeah. And for the record,
it's been a rough night, too, the last days.
Please introduce yourselves.
Good morning, sirs. My name's Marie Allen, and I live at the Holiday Hills Mobile Home Park, and I'm here with a couple of friends and residents. We have recently been acquired by a company of investors apparently located in the state of California. The process started in April of last year where this park was starting to be sold, and we became one. They went from 7 to 20 properties and 5,000 tenants, and we just January 18th was when it finalized. So we got this nice letter from Harmony Communities there. We're the only site in Oregon that they have. All of these other properties are all located in the state of California. So they gave us this welcome to the community. We're going to do all this for you, nice and whatever. And then 2 or 3 weeks later, about 30 of us were served with 30-day notices to fix violations on properties, and I've got some of the violations. They basically have sent us these proposed rules and regulations. We have no lease or anything at this point in time. We've been convicted or find based on this information. I'm sorry I didn't get it to you last week. I was supposed to. And so there's about 30 of us. People have been assigned notice for things that they weren't even supposed to take care of. For instance, a neighbor, Sharon, they've got violated for taking care of trees. The previous owner would never let us touch the trees, and you really don't want me with a chainsaw in the park. I've already decapitated the top of the gas hose with the lawnmower, so I'm banned from anything that moves too quickly. And so now the park actually had a $60,000 budget slated for taking care of these trees. It's 11-acre property, and these trees are $2,000-$3,000 to be taken down. So this is being passed on. People are being violated for having cars that they don't have and so on. So it's a mess. And we've got really a lot of people that are on the process, those that can afford it, of getting out of the park. We're going to have a mass exit.
May I chime in a second here?
Yeah.
My name is Linda Vellucci, and I'm a tenant there. I need to really emphasize that this park is about 35 years there. As she said, it has been recently purchased. The park is about 80 tenants.
There's 85.
Yeah, 85.
There's 85.
About 75% of those are trailers. And could be called RV. There's some little bit, if you look it up, it's a little bit, you know, what, iffy. So out of those, that number, in terms of people that live in trailers, they have really been the ones that have been focused on. This community, this is very important. This community has been around for a long time, mostly very low income and mostly elderly. If they are forced by either all their rules, if they are forced with that, they are going to be, oh my gosh, where do I live? Because a lot of the trailers are very old. They would never be able to be moved. The people have nowhere to go. They're low income. They're Social Security. They're very limited. So I just wanted to throw that picture and to paint a little picture of the frustration of what's going on. And I'll turn it over to her.
And the other thing is these rules that they've sent to us that we've been violated on and given 30 days to fix. And they're telling some folks, well, that's really not a 30-day notice for you to move. And it's like, well, it says at 9 o'clock on April 9th I have to be out and you're going to take my home and blah, blah, blah. Well, that's not what we really mean. What we really want you to be doing is to know that you're fixing things up, which we do. We want it fixed up. We have no problem with that. But in the event that we're not able to meet all of the violations, then apparently they're going to give us another 30-day. So now apparently that 30-day takes us to that third no cause, that they can kick you out for no cause. And so we're really of the assumption, we've never met these folks, they've never shown a face. These park rules that we are supposed to adhere to, they're not even pertinent to Oregon. They're California parks.
And chiming in one more second is that because of that very reason, they really don't know what's going on. They're getting all their information. We're Holiday Hills. They are Harmony Communities. And they're getting their information from a manager that is extremely biased.
Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to cut you off. You're running out of your time.
Okay, sorry.
What can we do?
We don't even know that you can even do anything. It's just we want you to know that we've got some scumbag California company that's coming in, and the feeling is that they wanted to get everybody kicked out so they can build some nice new shiny condos out there.
So, I worked a lot on this issue when I was in the legislature, and it's been a lot of years, and I have to review the laws. The state of Oregon has a lot of laws that should be somewhat protective of you. I think you need to get someone who's familiar with this. And there's, Wayne, in the lobby, there's an advocacy group for exactly this kind of thing. But I think the first place, and I'm going to look at Wayne, is Arnold Husing has had some experience in that.
which is in the planning department. Is it the right place to refer them that maybe...
Maybe I can, outside the meeting, get more information for you. I think I can do a couple of referrals. I've got a couple of ideas. Yeah. And then,
yeah. We're manufactured home owners, tenant association, I believe, that John Van Hanningham... John Van Hanningham leads, I imagine. That's what you're thinking of.
Like John
Thompson. But he has just retired at the end of the session.
But I have other ways to get resources.
Possibly legal aid. But unfortunately, this is not the first time I've heard a story like this about a manufactured home park in Lincoln County or elsewhere in Oregon. And with my work with the Housing Alliance, we tried last year, got the bill through the House, but it died in the Senate, unfortunately, to limit no cause evictions, try and strengthen the hand of tenants, folks like you and the folks you're talking about. But unfortunately, the property owner lobby carried more clout than tenants, because tenants, unfortunately, until enough horror stories get to the desk of legislators, that we're going to see this continuing to happen. But if we can connect you with anybody who might be able to put you in the strongest legal position possible, we want to do that.
20 years ago, it's been going on. There was a whole movement of these types of California groups to move in, and there was some law changes there. Now, to strengthen it, that's why I say I haven't reviewed that area in a long time, but I think you've got some opportunities, but I can't. I'm not up to speed on it anymore. We'll
make sure we get you some resources that can help you.
Thank you.
Address some of these.
Again, I don't want you to think that we're not hearing what you're saying and we're not insensitive. We certainly appreciate the situation that you're in, and Council Belmont will be able to provide us some
Thank you so much. I can tell you something. They won't be getting a lot of people moving in, because nobody's going to move in, put $70,000 down for a manufactured home, and put their own concrete driveway and sidewalk that the county doesn't
have. The notes that they have, the amendments they have, they are like, I mean, they want, wow. They want now gravel. Now they want cement, and you're responsible for your driveway and carports and all that. And that is in their new rules in here. So I don't know if you
want. I'll talk to you after.
Okay. Share that with Council Belmont again.
Thank you so much.
Hopefully, we'll be able to provide
ear.
You with at least some direction for
Thank
some
you.
Support.
Thank you.
It was an interesting morning. Thank you.
Thank you.
I didn't know you guys.
Sorry you had to wait
so
long.
Work.
This is a long meeting today.
I learned a lot, though.
Yeah. Well, good. Thank you for coming.
All right. Is there any other constituents?
So we just stay and wait for you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sit back there and look.
We should
be
done shortly. Is there any other constituent input? All right. Seeing none, next meeting of the Board of Commissioners will be on Wednesday, March 28th, 9:30 a.m. here in the Board of Commissioners room at 108. And with that, we're adjourned.